Good morning, everyone, and welcome. We're delighted to see you this beautiful Sunday morning. And as is our custom, we introduce newcomers to our little pamphlet called The Declaration of ULT. This one is noted, it says Philadelphia, ULT. But on the back of this little pamphlet, you see listed 27 other ULTs situated all over the world. Can't hear my voice? Just raise your hand and I'll yell a little louder. Okay? This declaration introduces you to what takes place here every Sunday and every Wednesday. As you see, we began at 11 o'clock and it will be done at 12 today. And it will be a format of a forum or a talk or a panel. So let us see what takes place in a few minutes here in these rooms. Wednesdays is the next day. We open the doors at 5:30 so that you can come in and visit our library, talk to the volunteer in the library about the library and the rest of the building, peruse a wonderful supply of literature, not only particular documents and volumes relating to theosophy, but literature, history, science, anything you wish. We have, we wanted to tell you, there's an old-fashioned card library, a quad file. We don't use those things much anymore since computers came on the scene, but in there, if you have a title and you want to look it up, ask the librarian to help you with that file. 7:30, told you we'd come in at 5:30, 7:30, library closes and you have 15 minutes till the meeting begins in this particular room on Wednesdays. At the present time on Wednesdays, we're completing our examination of The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. First time you heard that name, you can inquire, who is Mr. Judge? Because on here it states that broadcast the teachings of theosophy is recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. Those names you should become familiar with. All the work in this lodge is carried on by voluntary contributions of time, work, and effort, supported also by voluntary contributions of money. No obligation. Entirely a voluntary contribution of money as well as time. There's one special meeting that we'll have Wednesday the 22nd.
Not listed on here,
but we just happen to know that, White Lotus Day, is that correct?
No. ULT Day.
ULT Day. That takes place this month. I don't think there's anything else. Oh, yes. We do have www.ultphiladelphia.org on the computer. Take one of these home with you and check it out. Also, it's the policy of many of us to fold this little paper over like that and put it in our pockets, because on the back it tells you in just a few words what we are about here and how you too may participate if it's so you so desire. Are there any other questions?
We are working in the month of June, the merry month of June. And the theme for the month is practical theosophy, a wonderful kind of consideration, especially as at the start of the summer months when we may be trying out some different activities and different modes of living. Last Sunday, a panel considered, is brotherhood practical? And this Sunday, we will have a short talk entitled The Well-Examined Life, and then there will be lots of time for Q&A.
the well-examined life. What a difficult time we residents of the industrialized world live in. The technology of the last 125 years has shattered our ability to concentrate. We are tethered to our work, social obligations, family and friends, by a host of high-tech gadgets. Bound up in this little prison of flesh by electric cords, radio waves, misunderstood ideas, and unexamined beliefs. What can we possibly do to free ourselves from this self-created prison? Man, know thyself, was the inscription that greeted visitors at the famed temple at Delphi, its purpose being to remind anyone entering the shrine of mysteries what the ultimate scope of his initiation ought to be. Most members of our modern society, encountering such a command, would think it didn't apply to their hectic and sometimes frantic modern lives. And they would probably respond with their name, occupation, family ties, mother, father, children, religious, civil, and civic memberships. What they fail to realize is that even though they are attached and held hostage by a gaggle of gadgets and temporary obligations and beliefs, there is a small, constant inner voice that is quiet and eternally present. This small voice that at rare times breaks through the roar of modern life, giving insight to age-old problems and peace to troubled minds, leads us to the question, how do we gain access to this ally and friend more often? Theosophy informs us, and study verifies that, the more the mind dwells on a thing or situation, whether pleasurable or painful, the less chance is there for it to become detached. You cannot have an attachment for something you don't think about. Therefore, the first step must be to fix our thoughts on the highest ideal and connect with that ideal. Honest self-examination that allows the observer to become aware of the true desires and motives which drive their actions brings them closer to their higher aspirations and potential. The driving power behind such a practice and its development is what was called by the ancients Fava, which is in secret, and of which H.P.B. wrote in The Key to Theosophy, that Fava is in man himself, unrestricted by age, social status, or gender. She went on adding, our inner spiritual self is the only God we have a chance of cognizance of. And she asks, how can this be otherwise? God is a universally diffused, infinite principle. How can man alone escape from being soaked through by and in the deity? The Christian Bible concurs, saying in 1 Corinthians 3:16, know ye not that ye are the temple of God and that the Spirit of God dwelleth in you? As you can see, self-examination comes to us highly endorsed and should not be taken lightly or casually. It is the foundation of humanity's destiny and the springboard of man's ever-becoming. In the well-examined life, humanity's highest qualities are encouraged to grow: compassion, altruism, cooperation, and other noble qualities find fertile soil in which to prosper. Plato gave expression to this idea when he was quoted as saying, "The ardent turning of the soul towards the divine, not to ask any particular good, as in the common meaning of prayer, but for good itself, for the universal supreme good." Even a slight observation of this practice returns significant benefits on your investment of time. There are many popular mindfulness movements today that teach their students to be observant of themselves, to occupy the present and not to dwell in the past or speculate in the future, promising a reduction in stress and clearer thinking as a reward for this practice. The reward is even greater for the student of theosophy. The practice, accompanied by sincere study, an open mind, and a willing heart, delivers not only clear thinking and a release from stress, but an introduction to you, the true you, the highest part of you, the savior you, the eternal you. The voice of the silence says, before the soul can see the harmony within must be attained, and fleshy eyes be rendered blind to all illusion. Before the soul can hear, the image man has to become as deaf to roarings as to whispers, the cries of bellowing elephants as to the silvery buzzings of the golden firefly. Before the soul can comprehend and may remember, she must unto the silent speaker be united. Just as the form in which the clay is modeled is first united with the potter's mind. For then the soul will hear and will remember, and then the inner ear will speak the voice of the silence.
The well-examined life. And as we just heard, certainly we see many traces of that advice in all the popular media, in all the self-help books, in various associations and organizations. But these are ancient, ancient thoughts. And I'm sure you came here with modern thoughts or ancient thoughts on this very same subject. Way in the back.
As was just said, there are all those different modalities of examining one's life. So how do we fish through all those different types of practices and know which one is the way we should go?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. When we think about most of the modern psychology or self-help gurus who have done a degree of scientific investigation, the most curious thing for a student of theosophy is that most of these scientific investigations started in the mid-1970s. And we're reminded that if we look at the work of Herbert Benson, who was the father of the relaxation response or the transcendental meditation movement, if we look at Langer, who's studying mindfulness in a variety of different ways, or Seligman at Penn doing authentic happiness, et cetera, it goes on and on and on. The scientific investigations that start in the 1970s are frequently actually researching ancient concepts that we could find in the Gita, we can find in the words of the Buddha, we can find in the words of the Sermon on the Mount, and we certainly can find these terms in the theosophical movement that recommenced or emerged again in 1875 to 1899. No matter where we're looking at these ideas, if we're concerned with the validity or the truth of the practice, as students of theosophy, we've got three fundamental principles or propositions that we could use as a ruler to see if the modern thinking lines up with the ancient. What's the source of life? What is the source of mind, spirit? How does it work? Are there cycles, cause and effect? What is it? And then what's the purpose of that? If the purpose is evolution of the entire degree of manifestation of every level or degree of soul or mind, then the purpose has to be altruistic. And if we use those kinds of measuring sticks, we can begin to judge what we see in externals. We have a way of talking with another who may not know anything about the body of the philosophy of theosophy, but they may be curious about the mind-body connection. And one of the most interesting subjects was actually done by a scientist, Judith Roden, who's University of Pennsylvania, who partnered with Ellen Langer at Harvard, and they looked at the premise of service and what impact it would be if the proposition is the mind and the body are one, then what effect scientifically would come from kindly service to others. And they used nursing home patients who were losing their faculties and control over the physical and gave them houseplants, either with instructions of how to nurture the houseplant or without instructions on how to do it, and just ask them to intuitively serve the houseplant. And in both cases, the houseplants thrived, and so did the patient. And this oneness of life was emerged through this use of social psychology. So those would be some of the ways we could begin to judge some of these sources. Yeah.
It seems that a lot of folks, at least for probably large portions of their lives, do not live the well-examined life. Especially in the West. And Socrates said that an unexamined life is not worth living. Why is it so intense? I mean, not worth living?
Socrates is definitely the source of the well-examined life quote. And there are a whole series of Socratic quotes that you can get off the net. The first one of which pops up across key searches is the unexamined life is not worth living. If we think about the notion of we are soul, we are oneness, resident living in and through physicality, living in and through personality and the psychic or emotional planes, if we are indeed mind, the perceiver, in these physicalities, these lower substantial planes of existence, then what's life all about? If we go through life, and we can test this out for ourselves, we wake up in the morning and just shoot right off the mattress and then move through life in terms of like a ball in a pinball machine, and we're just reacting to whatever events might happen, to the influences of others, to our surroundings, to some incredible event we hear on the news or we witness, there's no meaning. Man is a meaning maker. Man, meaning humans, all degrees of humans, wherever we may encounter them, are soul in action, potential to perceive. And we make meaning from life by how we perceive and think. If as children we're left in cribs for months and years and are never stimulated and we're never offered words with which to think, then life has a very different kind of implication or effect, and it is meaningless. There's no creative entity experiencing, becoming aware of the experience, considering it, learning from it, reframing it or interpreting it, sharing it with another, and then using it as a platform for service for others. What, the yellow shirt way in the back.
If, as was said in the talk and Theosophy teaches, I am a spiritual being, why is it when I go to examine myself, what I see is the opposite? Many faults and obstacles and self-made problems. How does Theosophy explain that?
Well, if we are making the attempt to be self-aware and to perhaps set a tone in the morning, be the opposite of the pinball machine effect. We arise in the morning and take a quiet period to reflect and to gather thoughts and motives and fine-tune them and set a tone for the day. And then we make the effort to move through the day mindfully as best we can. And then at the end, to sit in self-examination and reflection. Theosophy would remind us that the entity, excuse me, the entity doing that is soul, is eternal, is changeless, and the ability to perceive that was the morning, these were the moments, this is now, and this might happen in the future. The ability to be changeless amid life and all of its changes and the universality of motion means that we are not flaws, we are not assets, we are not the personality, we're not the body, we are not the attitudes held, we're not the knee-jerk reactions, but rather we're the proactive force observing all of that. And that duality of soul in and through mind, in and through body, personality, and that differentiation, I am, and everything else is external, everything else is environmental, shows us that as soul, we're true identity. Everything else is experience and the basis of perception. Your hand again.
But what is the source of that difficulty and negativity I see? If I'm spiritual, where does it come from?
If we are soul, creating thoughts, entertaining motives, leading unexamined lives in which no effort has been made to clean up the ethical side of life or to perfect our use of matter, or little effort to serve the whole, the harmony of the universe, then we have set up through past lives, for many, many lives, for many days in this particular incarnation, we have set up causes and habits, scandic tendencies, cell memories that have lives that we've imbued them with life and energy, and they come back literally to haunt us until we learn to step, detach, be aware of them, think about them, work with and through them, and better fine-tune our use of motive and energy and desire and will. Yeah.
I volunteered to read the declaration, but on the back it says that the purpose here is to give out the three fundamental principles and exemplification and practice of those principles. So how do those three fundamental ideas relate to our topic this morning?
Well, if we're talking about the well-examined life, and that is the only one worth living, it's a purposeful process, if you will, then we are dealing with the proposition that there is a source, there is soul, there is spirit that is far above and beyond the mundane existence of our daily life. And secondly, the proposition that everything moves in cause and effect, in cycles and periodicity, that there are periods of activity and rest, that there is an expression of a cause and then an impression, an effect made from that cause. That's the basis for self-examination, is it not? I am soul, I am perception and potential, perceiving, experiencing, becoming more and more aware of effects that are returning to me, of the way in which I can cause things to occur and then more effects come to me. I become more and more aware that there may be great cycles of my physical health, of my mental health, of my emotional stability. I may become more and more aware that things that have happened in the past can circle back, but this time, when similar circumstances reoccur, I can meet them in a different way, with experience gained, with a little more knowledge, a little more skill, or perhaps in a well-examined circumstance, I can look into the eyes of another soul struggling with a life problem and find empathy and find experience, identification. And I can intuitively find that third fundamental, that we're here to evolve as soul and to assist all a manifestation. And maybe I now have something to bring to the table. I've examined daily life for myself. I found something to be true. And just maybe I can offer assistance to another struggling to become empowered. Yeah.
Wouldn't the fact of feeling responsible for our life and our life actions, the idea of karma and reincarnation, if we don't feel responsible for our world around us, why examine our life? For what purpose?
Well, just as there's an array of degrees of thinking, and just as we may become aware, you know what? I thought I was doing a kindly thing, but oh wow, look at the mixed motive that I hid even from myself. Even those of us who are just beginning to wake up to spirit in action, and we're just beginning to say, wow, there's more to life than just the temporary physical and a passing fancy. Even if the motive at the beginning is very self-centered or selfish, I want to know more because I'll be free of stress. Or I want to be more aware of the self-examination because I want a healthier body. Even if the implication is for me, that's still a stage of growth, isn't it? And gradually across time with the effort, the soul searching for truth, seeking truth, will gradually become less and less selfish, more and more self-centered, but self-centered on the way to becoming selfless. It's a process. It's an unfolding. So even if we're not particularly spiritual in some ways, there are degrees of value of the well-examined life. Uh-oh, I talked too long. Yeah.
Getting back to that third fundamental, that the purpose of life is to learn. The author of that quote being Socrates, he tells a story of a young man who came to him and wanted to learn from Socrates, and Socrates says, "You're not ready. When you want to know truth as much as a drowning man wants to breathe air, then you can come to me." And we think that's key to understanding why he would think just life for sensation and pleasure is not worth living. And to do all these things, to examine your life, you really have to open to the realization that we're here to learn, that there's more than just this physical existence.
Mm-hmm. Socrates is also in the world of educational psychology. Socrates is the basis for all inquiry methods of teaching. And the Socratic method, teaching by asking questions, based on the notion that intuitively there's a powerhouse within each of us, that inquirer within actually has the answers to the great questions of life if they will pause and turn within and then use that information to answer questions or to problem solve or to seek new solutions. And in many cases, what Socrates was saying was things like this quote: "I know you won't believe me, but the highest form of human excellence is to question oneself and others." So as teacher, Socrates would be looking for the student, not who comes as a baby bird with an open mouth, but as a seeker of truth who would come armed with questions. Yeah.
And we think in some lifetime, since we repeat and work through our karma, at some point we have the sense that this isn't all there is. There is an intuition that arises that sort of gives us the direction towards you need to examine. So at some point, we naturally, we think, will turn to examine and find out why I'm not satisfied. There must be more than this going on. But we have to make that initial leap or request. But we think in some lifetime, everyone comes to that. They've gone through levels of materialism and, you know, the house got bigger and the car got more expensive. It's not enough. I'm not satisfied. There must be more to this, more to life than this. So at some point, we think that naturally arises. We can suppress it, certainly. But if we pay attention to it, we're on our way to this process.
Well, we don't even have to worry about some life off in the future. If we observe children, if we observe souls in crisis, where there's been a real crossroads in life and some serious issue has arisen, we frequently see that each event in life, especially the ones that seem to be more dramatic, each event in life is actually an invitation or a springboard to wonder why. And that impulse of, what the Harrys is that all about? That doesn't seem fair. Where's the justice in that? Or how many times have we caught ourselves saying, I don't get it. Why would so-and-so do such a thing? I don't get it. All of that puzzling, all of that wonderment, all of that reflection is innate in us. It's innate in that duality of soul working through matter, through substance. And each moment, moment by moment, we've got the potential to go through that process. And it is said time and time again that it's in the mundane, it's in the tiny little events of a particular day, that we may find the greatest invitation of all, or that aha moment that Oprah is so fond of. Oh, aha, I've just had an aha moment. That becomes the really remarkable thing. There's a series of articles in Magazine Theosophy from the 1930s, 1933, The Pursuit of Self-Knowledge. And in some of those articles, the trials of life, the daily little events, the daily little duties that we face are actually the degrees of initiation of soul development. And we don't often think about that because, frankly, we're waiting for this fireworks and this tremendously dramatic point of transformation. You know, somebody's going to arise and elevate. Somebody else is going to, you know, levitate off the couch. We've swallowed hook, line, and sinker this this image of perfection instead of turning around and quietly saying, whoa, wait a minute, the moment of perfecting, the creative moment of thinking about something and then offering it up and turning it from casual to causal. That's where life's magic is. Yeah?
Well, then you're saying that the literature that's given out, some of it free, some of it very reasonable price.
A little bit louder, please.
Most of it free, and the declaration, and so forth, at a reasonable price. And it gives us direction how we should get out of ourselves. Put it that way, and with these fundamental ideas of deity, law, and evolution, in its simplest form, examine ourselves, and there's a feeling we get that what we see in the mirror is not really me, and then we discover there's something in us that is superior to our experiences. Otherwise, you wouldn't even know you had it. So the idea is to change our focus. And these fundamental ideas, I understand, in simple language, gives us a basis for continuing to do it every day.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Very simple propositions that have nothing to do with an ostentatious expression of life, has nothing to do with accoutrements of technology or fancy living, et cetera, but has everything to do with a purification of heart and mind and body. If you're available any Wednesday night or you have access to online, you might look into an article by William Q. Judge called Musings on the True Theosophist's Path. It's a lovely, lovely compilation of thoughts on daily life and trying to live the life of spirit in matter. But there's an old Mumbai publication, a series of pamphlets, and in the introduction to Musings on the True Theosophist's Path, in a Mumbai pamphlet, is this statement: he who loves lives. He who loves himself lives in hell. He who loves another lives on earth. He who loves others lives in heaven. And he who silently adores the self of all creatures lives in that self, and it is eternal peace. It's a lovely, lovely statement. And isn't that a statement of gradually becoming more and more and more aware of self being one in all? Only comes with a well-examined life.
In an article that HPB put in one for magazine on self-development, self-knowledge, it begins with this statement that the first step is to remind ourselves that we are continuously self-deceived. What does that mean, that we are continuously self-deceived?
We are continuously self-deceived. Earlier in this morning's presentation, there was a statement made that I am soul, and everything else beyond that experience, expression, sense of existence. Everything else is environment. Everything else is illusion. So if we think about most mornings that we don't wake up and sit in contemplation or meditation or prayer, however we want to phrase that, if we just hop from I exist, I am, that state of awareness of existence, right into I am this body, I am this personality, I am these opinions, I am this schedule that I've got for today, I am all these little duties, oh my God, my back hurts, I am that pain. All of those things that we add as thinkers to that initial experience of existence, everything else is the source of delusion, of illusion. And we can, as conscious entities, and I'm not saying it's easy, and I'm not saying that this particular student can hold and sustain this, but if, as thinkers, even once, we can be in the middle of crisis in the external, even if once we can step back from that and, like peeling an onion, wait a second, I'm not that, I'm not that, I'm not this, I'm not this. We go through a shaving process and say, I am. I'm experiencing all that. Even if we can do that once, then as in nature, there's nothing comes but once. That can be repeated and strengthened and enlarged upon, practiced until it's a natural bloom the way the flower blooms. There's a hand back in this corner.
We have heard that Ben Franklin was instrumental in opening up one of the first prisons, and that the reason for the cells or so forth was to isolate the prisoners so that hopefully they will examine their life. Now, apparently it hasn't worked. So I guess the question is, you cannot make anyone examine your life if they don't want to. If they think, well, I just don't want to look at it. I just want to keep on living my life the way I'm living it. And all these things that happen, just bad luck, misfortune.
There's a couple of different things in the notion of the Ben Franklin design for solitary cells. One is the new brain research that even several hours in solitary confinement, let alone months and years in solitary confinement, leads to brain malfunction and insanity. It would be a rare human being who can sustain that, and why? Because we are, as soul, living in bodies that are basically of the animal kingdom. We are gregarious. In other words, we seek group. And frankly, in this field of experience, if we are one, as soul, we connect with others. We see the soul in others. So whether or not someone is aware I'm a spiritual being, at some impulse level, they are seeking companionship, seeking even the friction that can occur between two human beings, and needing that kind of stimulation. As to the point about we can't force another to be reflective or meditative, Franklin's design for that solitary confinement to force reflection brings up a whole other issue. As soul, as creative entities, we operate on the basis of free will and desire, the use of will and imagination and concentration and free choice. And the way that soul blooms is this use of these forces, the use of the spiritual entity, and then registering, becoming aware of effects. Truly, the one human being that we can work with is the one that we see in the mirror each day. There's a research being done, and the book is called The Conscious Parent. The foreword is written by the Dalai Lama. The professor, a doctor of clinical psychology, is at Columbia. And the entire premise behind that book is very theosophical and harkens very much to the articles of what is a theosophical education, that you can't force another soul. The soul is already divine and perfected and is making an attempt to be expressed through childhood. Yeah.
In India, and you can look it up online, it's fascinating, a woman who wasn't just the warden of the prison, she was the head of the prison system. She instituted meditation. And many of the prisoners, these were all men, didn't want to do it, but came along because they were ordered to. And the atmosphere of the others affected them so much that the whole prison system was altered by that one mechanism. So they weren't forced, but they were introduced to something. But we wanted to say, for those who cannot go the philosophical or the intellectual route, there's also the downright physical and practical.
Mm-hmm.
You said if you can only do it once, well, if you stop and look at a biorhythm chart, and then you see, oh my goodness, every 6 weeks I'm in a very bad mood.
Mm-hmm.
That means I'm not in the mood. The mood comes to me, and it's what I do with it. So we can find ways to prove these ideas physically. Just prove it once, and you have the power to alter it.
Absolutely. And if we premise that second proposition that there's karma, cause and effect, there's no judgment made. It's not good karma. It's not bad karma. It just is cause and effect. So if we can do that self-aware study of biorhythms or whatever appeals to us, each of us is going to come to this study from a different tactic. Applied theosophy is that which appeals to the skandhic tendencies of the body, the personality of this particular incarnation. There's your starting point. Grow where you're planted. You don't have to rip up your roots and look at them. That's not what it's about. That'll kill the process. But literally, if we're planted and we see seeds blooming, we see tendencies happening, we notice that they occur in certain conditions or in certain cycles, or if something, we get caught up really short, something happens and we find ourselves reacting in a shocking manner, then we've got a fertile field to say, whoa, what was that? What was that about? How can I look at that in view of the three fundamentals? What lesson is there to learn, and how might I turn that so I can help somebody else with what I've observed? Yeah.
Because universal brotherhood is a fact in nature, in examining ourselves as part of nature, we can also learn a lot about ourselves and help ourselves by examining the world around us. So we're thinking of a particular example of the Birdman of Alcatraz,
right,
who lived most of his life in solitary confinement. And we have in the Phoenix Fire Mystery this statement that while in prison he got a copy of the Secret Doctrine, and it woke him up to his real nature, and it was at that point where he dedicated himself to the study of birds. An expert in your textbooks, right? But it was how that devotion to the well-being of another saved him.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he had no other people to talk to, he found some other group of beings to care about and to study, and the effect that had on him.
perfect example of a human being remaining a creative force in isolation, but serving the wants and the needs of other living things. And there's also other cases across time of prisoners who have made pets out of roaches. And that's not a chuckle. That is one human being making an effort to connect with another living entity and to serve the entity, to feed crumbs to the other entity. Yeah.
So if that's the case, the need that human beings have to be of service to others and the healthy environment within themselves that is engendered when they are, isn't it interesting that human beings, we think, being a parent, the parent, the person needs to be a parent to grow in that way, because a human being is a parent and is responsible for their children, we think, far longer than any animal.
Yes.
And so that really is all the more opportunity for the parent to personally grow, because they're in service to their children. I mean, forget even 18, they're in service to their children until nearly the deathbed.
And throughout the philosophy, we're taught that we're not to be cut and dry about anything. We don't have to be a householder or a parent, or we don't have to lead a life in beauty and grandeur of isolation, on some high mountain or in just the perfect idyllic natural scene to be of service. Each of us parents, each of us nurtures all of life with every breath that we take in, with every morsel of food that we take in, with every thought that occurs to us and that we energize, that we hold and use, or we focus on. We nurture every other point of life, every other point of intelligence, because we are soul, dynamos, spirit, working through all of substance. So whereas one soul who in this particular incarnation may have the deep privilege of parenting or fostering small children, another soul who has the deep privilege of fostering plants or animals, or just fostering loving thoughts with which to serve all of humanity, the opportunities are great and many.
Again, the contrast between feeling and intellect, we think one of the most joyous statements in Theosophy is Mr. Judge's realization comes from dwelling upon the thing to be realized. So you don't have to command this brilliant brain or mind. Just hold the idea and brood with it. Mm-hmm.
And in that statement comes a whole nother appreciation of those souls who may not look like us, they may not sound like us, they may not have access to technology, and their lives close to the earth in a far simpler setting may absolutely be an invitation to brood, to brood in the sense of a chicken warming eggs in an incubator, to incubate thoughts and seeds of future habits that will be a blessing to absolutely all. Yeah.
Reminds me of Stephen Hawking, who said something to the effect of, my body might be limited, but my mind has no limitations.
The mind has no limits. Yeah.
And the comment before that shows us that reading the literature and hanging on to a few ideas, very few, you discover something. The idea that we particularly care, hold on to, no man is your friend, no
every moment of every life, every encounter, every illusion, every environment other than I am. Every external is a potential for a teaching moment, for lifelong learning and lifelong living and loving. And fortunate are we that we don't have to rely on the birds outside the window alone or a tiny little roach that might be a pet, but we are surrounded by many, many opportunities to be nurtured and to nurture in return. Part of the musings on the true theosophist path is this. This is the end of part two of the article. Live well your life. Seek to realize the meaning of every event. Strive to find the ever-living and then wait for more light. The true initiate does not fully realize what he's passing through until his degree is received. If you are striving for light and initiation, remember this, that your cares will increase, your trials thicken, your family make new demands upon you. He who can understand and pass through these patiently, wisely, placidly, may hope. Fear nothing that is in nature and visible. Dread no influence exerted by sect, faith, or society. Each and every one of them originated upon the same basis, truth, or a portion of it at least. You are at war with none. It is peace you are seeking. And again, it is in the truth, in the experience of existence, I am, that we find the evidence that if that is my realization, it is the realization of every other self-conscious entity, every other human being, each moment that they awake in the morning. We are one in that, and if we could find it in our hearts to lead life in an examined manner so that we can see that moment of namaste, we can see it in any moment, in any event, in any circumstance, then we will literally be living in the eternal, living in the supreme, and certainly in the most amazing degree of serenity that we can imagine for ourselves and others. Our time is just about up, but again, there are fabulous, fabulous articles on Musings on the Theosophist Path, a whole series, The Pursuit of Self-Knowledge, and again, we're reminded that these ideas are eternal. We find them in essence behind religion, behind science, behind philosophy, and all we need to do is act as best as seemeth to each of us. We're out of time.
They're both online?
Oh, yes. All of these pieces of literature are online for free. Have a great week.
Thank you.